You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 13th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening,
and
folks.
We have a special guest rogue this week, Andrea Jones Roy. Andrea, welcome back to the SGU.
Thank you so much. Hi, everyone.
Great to have you on the show.
Hey, Andrea, let me ask you. Do you notice, I know it's anecdotal, but do you notice that the city is actually kind of hotter now?
I think it's approaching infinity, but it depends on if you want to use Fahrenheit or Celsius.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, yeah. But it's very hot. I've been blasting the AC all day to keep it from, like, being intolerable. It just doesn't cool down. And I'm also actively, you know, the cause of global warming, I think. Yeah.
So guess which number episode this is?
888.
Oh. Yep.
Good guess, Evan.
That's very auspicious.
Well, it would have brought it up.
Super auspicious, and they would love this number.
Yeah. Well done.
We're going to get a lot of downloads in China.
Oh, it means something.
Well, talking about good things, I just want to remind everybody, we have Nexus coming up, right?
Great segue, Jay.
Yes, I know. Well, you know, the fact that you're here and you're on the executive committee is, you know, it's. I have to talk about it. So I'm excited because we have a really cool topic this year. The topic this year is navigating the misinformation apocalypse. So we will be talking in many different ways about how to deal with all of the misinformation that's out there and people's experience with misinformation. And the keynote is going to be between Bill Nye and David Copperfield. And I had the pleasure of talking to them yesterday for an hour about the keynote because they wanted to, you know, go through all the different things that they could discuss. And we had a really fun and interesting conversation. And they have great stories to tell. And it's going to be a very, very fun discussion. So I hope that you join us. Go to nexus.org, N-E-C-S-S.org, and you can get your tickets there. And don't forget that if you buy the tickets, you could watch the conference for up to, you know, like 3 months after it airs. So it's available to you for a very long time.
Woohoo. Oh, Jay, we've been on the air. Jay, we've been on the air since 2005. Haven't we like already solved that problem? Why are we still working on this?
Misinformation thing?
Bob, it's worse now. Arguably, it's worse now than it ever was.
It absolutely is worse. We have failed.
Well, and we don't know the counterfactual of how much worse it would be if it weren't for the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, right? I mean,
at least
you're dampening
some of it. You know, Andrea, I would love to see statistics that will never exist, but I would love to know what the world would have been like today if the internet didn't come into existence.
That's interesting.
I was actually just reading a study today where someone tried to figure out whether getting off the internet was actually going to help people. It was like in the context of politics, and they did this study in the lead up to the midterm election where they were like, all right, these people get off Facebook for 3 months before the election and then like report back in. Not like a particularly well-controlled study. Anyway, the punchline is they were way happier. They were less polarized. They used Facebook less after the election when the study was over. And it's just Facebook, right? It's not the whole internet. But I was like, I got to get off.
Wow.
Yeah, I have dramatically decreased my use of social media outside of the SGU. Like I barely post things. I'm barely perusing. You know, I just don't want to have anything to do with it. It just irritates
me. It's exhausting. Yeah. But at the same time, I'm like, this is kind of my job, though, as a skeptic, as a science communicator. I mean, how can you avoid it? The whole point is that...
Steve, I feel the same way.
I know we're trying to convince people of a more rational approach to the really controversial topics. Like just today, on Science-Based Medicine, I wrote an article entitled Biological Sex is Not Binary, or The Science of Biological Sex, and the subtitle is, you know, Biological Sex is Not Strictly Binary. And people lost their freaking mind. Mm-hmm. I'm just going over the basic science. Like there's nothing scientifically controversial about anything that I say. But I mean, people, you know, just the amount, the degree to which they are willing to torture their logic in order to make some semi point, I'm not even sure what they're saying half the time, is just amazing.
Well, Stephen, I'm sure the science that you're writing about has been around a lot longer than the argument for the last few years that we've all been freaked out about,
totally.
Right? I mean, we've known about intersex people forever and ever. It's not like you're making up new science to defend some woke stance.
No, not at all. Of course, that's what the people think.
Yeah.
It's like it's also not controversial among actual biologists, you know? Biologists right. who yeah. study that's, this yeah, are like, yeah, of course yeah. it's not binary. Are you crazy? I mean... You know, here's a good example, and I think that the duck-billed platypus needs to become the poster child of the trans community, right? I'd love to see a duck-billed platypus saying that, you know, platypuses are mammals too, because some mammals lay eggs, right? It's like the exact same thing. It's like
we got to put that on.
There's
the flag.
No sharp line between evolutionary categories either. Biology is messy. You cannot,
messy,
and it just happens
messy.
To be that it's that human sexuality. First of all, it's not all about reproduction, and two, it's not strictly binary. There's lots of mishmash in the middle. That's just a fact.
Well, I remember the first time I learned that we don't really know, maybe it's changed since I heard this, you know, many years ago, but we don't really know where a species begins or
that's
ends,
correct.
Technically.
Right,
right,
yeah.
It's like really hard to say.
I mean, it depends. It depends on the species. It also depends on if you're only including extant members or extinct members. Like some species, like all their relatives could have died off, and they could be all there by themselves out at the end of some twig. And it's like pretty clear that, yes,
that's
one species.
It, yeah.
But evolutionarily, there is no sharp line. When did they stop being the same species as their most closely related other population? They're just populations, and populations are interbreeding. Like, we had this conversation last week with an expert on dog evolution. It's like, yeah, they're just spreading their genes all over the place. Like the idea of species, you know, is just you can't apply it. You can't draw any kind of lines here. You know what I mean? There's just too much interbreeding going on, and it's you can come up with some kind of functional semi-definitions, you know. It's like, you know, pseudo-objective, but it's like between planet and dwarf planet. We're just making up like criteria that sound good, you know, and just so we could have categories that make us feel good about ourselves. But I mean,
and then millennials freak out about losing Pluto.
They're a dwarf planet,
but the reality just doesn't conform to that, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I was hoping to just educate people a little bit about the biology of sex. Like, it's not all about gametes and chromosomes. You know, there's a lot more going on there, but they still freak out. You know, it didn't.
Well, you did educate them, right? But that doesn't stop them from freaking out. So they have to, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
hey,
maybe this is the most naive thing I've ever said, but maybe if we all just educate enough, at some point, we'll all come around. But I don't know.
Well, it's
speaking of Jay of the conference, like, I feel that this is a very urgent topic because I feel less confident about that than I did when I was, for example, was growing up, which is like, logic will win
out
eventually.
Another thing that we have to deal with, though, is that I feel like my life is infinitely more complex than it was when I was in my 20s. The internet introduces an incredible amount of complexity, and to a person that's wired like me, it really produces an extraordinary amount of stress.
Mm. Yeah.
So decoupling myself from social media and from, you know, other things that I've come to do on the internet actually is a de-stressor for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's also, I don't know, Jay, if this falls under the same category, but just like there's the social media part of the internet and like the voices and the communication, but there's also just, there's so much more information than we've ever had to confront.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Like, I used to have books in the evening news when my parents had it on, and that was sort of like, well, I know what's happening, and now there's no way to know all the
things. It's overwhelming. There's too many things to worry about.
Yeah.
There's just too much bad stuff and nonsense going on. You do have to focus a little bit and go, all right, this is my little corner of the nonsense that I'm going to deal with. And I just can't pay attention. I don't have the bandwidth for everything else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To some extent, you gotta prioritize. But it's hard. You can't do that entirely. Like, no matter what, I think we have to be aware enough to participate in our democracy. Like, we can't take it for granted anymore that it's just going to chug along. You have to pay attention or it could go bye-bye, you know?
Yeah.
There's just too many things like we have to pay attention to now.
And they all feel... and probably are very existential, right? It's hard for me to be like, because I agree with you, Steve, that democracy is a huge one, climate change, pandemics, future pandemics, dealing with this, the various potentials for this current one. You know, it's not like it's something that you're right, that I can be like, I'm just going to check out for a little bit.
I know, it's tough. Because, you know, because I'm the physician in the family and in the social group. I get a lot of these questions. So like, not too long ago, my wife was doing this. She's like, okay, so this person that we know had an exposure to somebody who was just diagnosed with COVID. Mm. And I just was put my head in my hands. I'm like, oh my God, I am so tired of these questions of having to troubleshoot everyone's pandemic, you know, exposure and everything. It's just exhausting. Of course, I happily do it, but I'm just saying it's just constant. It's happily.
So I should save my question, Steve, for after the recording. Right.
No, but it's true because everyone has to worry now about what do I do? It's like this updated CDC criteria about how we mitigate our risk and manage things. It's like, just get vaccinated. But, you know, it's
and boosted.
Yeah, and boosted.
And then maybe boosted again.
But yeah, right. And then just when we get a handle on this stuff, the monkeypox will come along and just throw a monkey wrench into everything.
At least the name is a little.
It's a little more fun. Right? I
feel a little bit more like we're in a movie.
I agree.
Now.
It's a little bit more fun than monkeypox, and we already have a working vaccine for it, which is good. They just have to produce a lot of it. So,
and then we get to hear from all the anti-vaxxers about why we shouldn't take it. So we have that conversation to look forward to.
Oh yes, that's forever now. Yep. That is ensconced.
Oh boy.
Well, uplifting talk. Everybody. Yes, that's great.
Hey, this is what we do.
But we also like to just talk about cool science, and that's mostly what we're going to do in the news item segment of the show this week. Starting with Jay, you're going to tell us about the race to create green steel.
Yeah, Steve. So we're at a point with steel production where the industry is trying to come up with new technologies that will get them off of fossil fuels. And, you know, it's interesting, the information that I have to share will fill you in on basically just how bad steel production is and how far it needs to come in order for it not to be very bad for the environment. So global steel production right now, you know, it's over about 2 billion metric tons produced annually. And that is an incredible amount of steel that, you know, globally that's being produced. Steel is, of course, essential for our, you know, the modern world and for our modern economy. It's ubiquitous. It's versatile. It has amazing capabilities. It is a cornerstone or a pillar of modern society. So we can't really live without it. And we have to work around, you know, what's happening today to get to a point where we could move forward and not destroy the planet. You know, like concrete kind of comes up in my head at the same time. Like we need concrete, and concrete production is bad too. So there's lots of technologies today that need to change, and steel is one of the biggest. So there is a heavy cost here with steel, because steel production creates up to 11% of the global greenhouse gas emissions per year. That's huge.
Yeah, that's a lot. No, we focus a lot on energy production, which of course is the biggest chunk, you know, transportation and energy, burning fossil fuels for that. But then, you know, there's other industries that contribute significantly. Yeah, so like basically 10%, you know, of greenhouse gases come from steel production. So that's a huge opportunity.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, when we finally do get there, it'll be a big game changer. So steel production, you know, over the years, of course, it's steadily increased, and it's going to continue to increase because every year demand goes up. It's estimated that steel production will increase by 33% by 2050, right? So that's a pretty significant increase. Half of the global steel production today, by the way, is made in China. The United Nations has said that industrial carbon emissions must be lowered in order to do what? Slow down global warming, right? You know, so, you know, no duh. But there's a lot of industries that have to spend an awful lot of money to do this. And industrial carbon emissions must be lowered by 93%, they say, by 2050. That's a lot of time, money, and consideration that needs to desperately be spent in order to slow down global warming, right? We're not going to stop it, but we need to slow it down as best we can. Steelmakers are desperately now looking to find new ways and to find low carbon technologies like using electricity and hydrogen instead of carbon producing energy sources. So it's becoming a very important thing to the industry. And we're seeing large companies and small companies trying to innovate technology to move away from the way that they produce steel today. Now, this is no small feat, because the steel industry, like I said, is huge. It's a huge industry. In 2017, global steel production was a $2.5 trillion U.S. dollar industry. That's tremendous. There are over 6 million people employed by steel manufacturers. That's tremendous. So changing a critical component of this industry is very, very likely to be a major disruption to a lot of people. And of course, huge amounts of money have to be spent in order to make all these changes. The most common way steel is produced starts with crushing iron ore until it's pellet-sized. And now what they do is while they're doing that, they're also preparing coal, they're heating it, and they're converting it into something called coke. So the iron ore and the coke are then combined with limestone, and they're put into a blast furnace, right? And a blast furnace is intensely hot temperatures. It burns the coke, and the mixture becomes liquid iron. And then that molten liquid iron is then put into an oxygen furnace where it's hit with pure oxygen, and this removes carbon from the liquid iron, and the result is crude steel. Now, just in what I said, there is so much energy being used to create the heat that they need. And the fact that the way that they're making the coke, right, which is made out of coal, right, that, of course, has an incredible amount of carbon in it. You know, and you won't be surprised to hear that this process goes back to the 1850s. And guess what? It produces a large amount of carbon dioxide all along the production line. So unfortunately, 70% of modern steel is still made this way, guys. So we're using technology that was made a very, very long time ago today. So check this out. For each ton of steel produced, 2 tons of carbon dioxide are emitted. That's insane.
Do the math. Wow.
That is a lot of carbon dioxide. Now, steel is also reclaimed as scrap and melted back down, and this accounts for the remaining 30%. This reclamation process uses electric arc furnaces, and as you can guess, these furnaces produce a significantly lower amount of CO2, and we could increase steel recycling as high as 45% of the global demand by 2050, but this would take a significant amount of government policy changes, and I think everybody knows that not to expect that, right? Because lots of global governments, you know, the big governments around the world today seem to not be able to get out of their own way. I certainly know that's the case here in the United States. Many companies have developed new methods of steel production that significantly or completely lower carbon emissions, but none of them have been scaled up to industrial size yet, right? And that's, we've talked about this many times on the show. If you can't scale up the technology, it's worthless, right? So having these ideas and having some technology that still needs to, all that engineering and all of that innovation that needs to be put into it in order to scale it up, that's what's going to take 30 to 50 years to do. And, you know, it's always a giant hurdle, but at least, you know, the work is starting to be done to get there. Another major concern is that new methods are developed that they'll be reliant on electricity, right? Now, why is that a problem? Because they're going to be reliant on a lot more electricity in order to do this. This means that solar and wind production has to be significantly increased. If the electricity used is being generated by burning fossil fuels, there isn't much gain here, right? You don't want to spark up a coal fire plant to fuel our green steel industry. It has to be renewable from the beginning, right? The renewable energy infrastructure has to be there to support the new electrical demand. So experts say that we will need approximately 3 times the solar and wind energy generation we have today just for the steel industry. So that alone is a whole other thing that has to happen while they are augmenting this technology and making new innovations. You know, they're also kind of waiting for the world to change. Another thing I read was that a lot of factories have been built in places that make it convenient to like get coal and bring coal to them. Like, so they're not in places that are near where solar panels are going to be and where that energy is going to be available. They've been built around the fossil fuel industry, which sucks because that means that, you know, a lot of factories might have to move and all sorts of change. This will likely increase the cost of steel production, you know, because if these companies start spending a ton of money to make all these innovations, that money has to come from somewhere, and they'll just raise the price of steel, which consumers will have to deal with as that transition is happening. And again, governments could offset some of these costs to consumers very easily if they could just make decisions. And China also, guys, unfortunately, is a major concern here because, one, no one really knows what's going on in China. The country has said that they plan to be carbon neutral by 2060. That's a pretty long way off, but not an unreasonable date. But still, you know, 2060 is a pretty far away from today. And meanwhile, China has announced that they are building 18 new blast furnaces, which are essentially the old technology. Okay, you're building more coal fire plants, and you're building more these traditional blast furnace factories. But so they don't have technology to transition their steel yet either, and they're 70% of the steel production. So lots of factors here, guys. Now, number one, I did not know that steel production was so bad for the environment. I had no idea. But right out of the gate, I mean, we need steel so desperately. You know, this isn't like, stop doing it. You know, we can't. We just can't. Society can't move forward without steel.
No, we need to find mechanisms of making it with less carbon. I mean, doing it electrically is the way to go. But of course, that means we need to ramp up our electricity, our green electricity production, right? If you're burning coal to make the electricity, it doesn't help, you know?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So that's the other thing. We talk about decarbonizing our energy infrastructure, but at the same time, we are increasing the amount of energy that we are producing. And that becomes even more dramatic if you include, oh yeah, and we're also going to decarbonize transportation by having electric cars. And the steel industry by making all electric, you know, steel production, so we're not burning, you know, fossil fuels there. Again, we have to, when we're doing these, running the numbers, we have to include that.
Yeah, and Steve, the backbone of the electric grid needs to be completely revamped, and we need to start doing that now, right now. You know, we have to be ready for all of these companies to be upgrading and changing the world over to completely to electric. And the fact that, you know, I don't know exactly what's going on globally, but I do know in the United States, almost nothing is happening.
Yeah. I haven't seen anything.
You know, if only we knew how important this was 20 and 30 years ago. If only we knew what we had to do.
Uttered a word.
If only scientists predicted this was going to happen, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I mean, and on the China side of things, where China's building, you know, sort of like old model, because that's where you're like, well, at least some countries can start anew, and China says, well, I'm not going to. I'm frustrated with that, but I'm also sympathetic, because I think China, India, other developing countries will say, you all got to pollute like crazy during your development, so we're going to do that too. But that's just going to lock them into this technology for even longer. Like it's depressing at every level.
Technology's advancing. That's the only thing good that's happening. But in terms of government or society or industry or whatever, there's really not much happening. You know, it's just a...
And it is hard to imagine a version where we don't all, as Jay was saying, either as consumers somehow pay more because the steel companies or the government steps in. Like, it just seems like from a short-term and sympathetic cost perspective, it's hard to, you know, the people who are getting solar panels in the United States are people who can afford to get them installed, even with government incentives, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's going to require.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's expensive.
And this is reminding me of a paper I read in like in 2010, when I think it was when Obama was in power and gas prices were really high then. And it was some paper, like an economics paper, that was like, given that gas prices keep getting really obnoxious, why aren't we seeing the market respond with alternatives to offset this hot raising cost? And basically the punchline in this particular article was, well, it's so there's so much fluctuation that there's no incentive to do anything long term. So it's like, yeah, gas prices are high. We all wish we had electric vehicles right now, but then gas prices went back down until now.
Yeah.
And so it's just this kind of punctuated pattern, too, that doesn't, from a business perspective, doesn't incentivize anyone to pay the costs up front. Maybe that'll change. Maybe it'll gas prices will keep being this high, and we'll all have to change what we're doing. I don't know. But that still doesn't address the steel thing.
Yeah.
And I'm just looking around at how much steel is around me, and it's...
Oh,
it's
yes.
New York. Yeah. Like, oh, sorry, everyone. I think 10% of the climate issues are from steel, and I think a lot of that steel is right next to me.
we talk about that a little bit in our upcoming book, The Skeptic's Guide to the Future, where in one part of the book, as they look around you, you're probably mostly surrounded by materials that we've been using for thousands of years.
Yeah, right. Mm.
Sure.
And so there's every reason to think that we'll be using steel far into the future. Yeah. It's a good material. Like, you know, it's not going anywhere.
If anything, steel has been sort of greenwashed from a marketing perspective to me, or I think, because it's like, oh, that's the sustainable, reusable steel this and steel that, as opposed to plastic, right? And that's, these things aren't free. Just like electricity still has to be powered by something. Yeah, yeah. It's not like it's a magic bullet, but it's tempting to think of it.
All right. Yeah. Let's talk about something that's pure fun now, right? There's no social implications to this whatsoever.
All
right. We're going to talk about the length of T-Rex arms.
Okay. Nice. My father was killed by T-Rex arms, so I'm offended. But other than that.
Well, sorry about that. trigger warning for anyone who has ever been mauled by a dinosaur. You guys know when T-Rex was first discovered? Give me a guess.
This
throughout
was
a year.
1883.
I was going to say 1950. That can't be right.
I was going to say 1920s.
No, it's the early 1900s.
1902.
Isn't it?
1902. Barnum Brown. Even when the first specimen was found, Brown did not think that the arms were part of that same skeleton. He thought, oh, this must be another specimen intermingled here. They just didn't go. And obviously this is like an iconic aspect of the T-Rex, that it has comically small arms that just seem incongruent with the otherwise massive proportions, you know, of the T-Rex. And it is still a bit of an enduring scientific question, not so much a mystery as just a question. And it's also just culturally, I think, iconic, right? Just the tiny arms of the T-Rex are easy to make fun of. So the question becomes, why are the T-Rex's arms so small, right? They are too short to reach their mouth, so they can't
be used. Are you sure?
I saw one smoking a cigarette once in a Gary Larson cartoon.
And it was really cool.
So, Steve, are you sure about that? Because I look at, you know, these reconstructions of T-Rexes, and it seems like, you know, that they could potentially reach the mouth a little bit.
If they tilt their neck.
Tilt their head down. Well,
crane.
But I
got to
say,
to
this
right.
is especially an interesting coincidence, because I'm reading a Neil Asher science fiction novel, and there's a lot of time travel. They're going back in time. It's fascinating. Great book called Cowl. And they talk about this guy's like, no, you guys got it all wrong about T-Rex. The arms were perfect for picking the decaying flesh from between its giant teeth. The guy's like, exactly. And he's like, the guy's like, I see it. Because he goes back in time. So I'm like, how cool is that?
Yeah, but in the world of real science, not science fiction, no, that is standard. The arms are too short to reach their mouth. They're only about 3 feet long.
Maybe they have good manners. They're using forks or chopsticks or something. The first tool users.
It's a really fascinating evolutionary question. And you could look at it from a couple of different directions. One is, what's the utility of the arms being that size? Like, how are they using the arms that where they could be that size or maybe might benefit from being small? But you could also look at it from a negative perspective. Maybe the arms are small to avoid a detriment, you know, because so that they're not getting in the way. Yeah,
right.
Or something. Mm. You know what I mean? Like pressure against a detriment versus for a utility. And of course, evolutionary forces are complicated. It's not like there's one thing that is causing a specific change, you know, all the time. Sometimes that could be the case, but often it's a balance of multiple factors, and evolution reaches some kind of homeostasis where all these factors are sort of in some kind of an optimal balance. And also there's coaptation, where morphology may change for one initial reason, but then that triggers other evolutionary forces that come into play. Like it can be used for some other
reason. Flight.
Yeah, exactly. You develop feathers for one reason, and then you could use them for flying. You know,
holy crap, I can fly now.
Yeah. So why would the arms be getting in the way? Right? That's one question. And the classic answer is because, you know, the T-Rex's head is so big. They're obligate bipeds, first of all, right? So they have to walk on two legs. They basically pivot. They're balanced on those two legs. And the head is balanced by the tail. So if you're trying to maximize the head, the weight in front of the legs, then the more the arms shrink, the more the front of the leg weight can be apportioned to the big jaws. And that's basically what the T-Rex is hunting and killing.
I like that
and
theory.
Eating with. Yeah, so that's one.
That
okay. Yeah,
that just, works for me.
They're small, so the head could be bigger. So that's one idea.
Okay. The arm throws off the balance.
Yeah, otherwise it'll throw off the balance.
Yeah, and a big mouth casts a wider
net. There is a recent, alternate hypothesis that derives from the belief, based upon evidence, you know, that T-Rexes may have hunted in groups. And they may have fed in groups, right? Because often multiple individuals are found, the remains of multiple individuals are found together. It doesn't necessarily mean that they hunted or ate together, because they may have just died together. But that's sort of indirect evidence. So if they did, the hypothesis is that if you can imagine a bunch of T-Rexes feeding on a carcass with their just huge destructive jaws, that you would want to get your arms out of the way.
Right? Yeah.
And that even, you know, incidental, accidental injury or maybe competitive injury, you know, to the arms could be deadly. You know, you get an infection and you die, right? So there would be selective pressure against having arms that were so small that they wouldn't get in the way when the bunch of T-Rexes are feeding on a carcass. That seems a little of a bit of a stretch to me, but okay. But, you know, that could have played a role. In addition, you know, I don't think that would be the primary thing. But then you could ask the question, why didn't they disappear entirely if they are just a detriment, right? So they stabilized at a size that has some other function. So what is that function?
Scratching their belly.
That, you know, they could certainly do that. They could certainly scratch their belly.
Yeah, is there an elbow joint? How much dexterity do they have?
Yeah, so I mean the arms. All right. So let me back up a little bit. There's another.
Right, back
There's
up.
Another
Come on.
Factor that we're going to add in here.
Claws.
And okay. That is the Ooh. Question, and because this will impact the thinking about it evolutionarily. Did the short arms of the T-Rex evolve only once or multiple times?
Why would they evolve multiple times?
Well, If they did evolve multiple times, that would argue
There's
towards some kind of a generalized evolutionary
benefit.
Pressure on this basic form. So in fact, there are
three
evolutionary groups all within theropod dinosaurs that have the same basic configuration of a huge
without common ancestors
and tiny arms without a common ancestor. So it evolved at least three times independently.
Wow.
There's the
Now we're talking, right?
So there's the tyrannosaurids, the Carcharodontosaurids and the Abelosaurids. There was a recent news item which has triggered me writing about this, where a recent discovery of a well-preserved Carcharodontosaurid that showed the small arm configuration. Previously, we didn't have a specimen with the arms, so now that makes a third group, not derived from or not with a common ancestor with tyrannosaurs with small arms, that independently evolved the small arm. So there's clearly something going on here evolutionarily. Also, we know that there were T-Rex ancestors with huge arms. And so there's no tiny-armed common ancestor. These are three independent groups, all of which involve tiny arms. So there's got to be some pretty profound evolutionary forces going on here. All right, so we talked about keeping them out of the way, balancing the big head. So what do you think? What are the hypotheses? How could the arms have been used? Now, of course, Andrew, I believe it was you who asked the question, well, what was their morphology? What did the arms look like?
Right.
And that's what triggered me to get to this point, because it depends on what species you're talking about, right? They're not all the same. But generally speaking, they're strong, muscular arms with, you know, a completely mobile shoulder and elbow joint.
Yeah, keep that in mind, though. I mean, in absolute terms, like a T-Rex's arms were diesel. They could curl. I read they could curl 200 pounds each arm. 200, that's a lot. That's a strong
three
arm.
3 feet. 3 feet. Yeah. That's, you know, compared to the T-Rex, they're tiny. But in absolute terms, they're pretty robust. They could do stuff.
I'm like looking at my own arm and feeling insignificant.
Yes,
they're
much bigger than your arm. They basically,
I gotta hit
their
the gym.
Arms are more like a 6-foot-tall person's leg. That's like a general proportion.
Okay.
If you want to think about how big they were. So they clearly were doing stuff. They weren't vestigial, just out of the way little stubs.
Right.
They were usable, you know, as Bob said, diesel arms.
And with claws.
The technical scientific term.
With claws.
Don't forget the claws, man.
Some species, in fact, had huge claws. Huge claws, not just tiny little claws. Which suggests that they are being used not just to hold things or for whatever, some non-combat purpose, that, you know, a huge claw implies
grasping.
Not just grasping, that they were using it as a weapon. They're weapon-sized claws on some of these small-armed theropod dinosaurs in these three groups. All right, so...
They were tackling.
Yeah, so what would that mean? So there is a fairly recent hypothesis. The first one I found in 2017. I like this one. Now, if you can imagine wrestling, you know, with a Tyrannosaurus, whether it's with another, you know, competitor of the same species or with a prey species, if they get inside its huge mouth, close to the body, it might be.
I mean,
difficult.
Outside the mouth, but not inside the mouth, but inside away
from. I meant inside their attack radius. You know what I mean? Anyone who has sparred, right? Anyone who has sparred, especially with a reach weapon, Jay and Evan, I know that you're familiar with this. If your enemy gets inside your reach, you're toast, right? Because you can't really effectively fight against them.
Like a rifle inside a close, like inside a building.
Yes, or if you have like a two-handed sword, right? You're fighting with a Scottish claymore. A massive sword, and somebody with a dagger gets up really close to you, you're pretty much toast.
Sword
useless.
Yeah.
That's the strategy.
Unless you have little arms coming out of your chest.
Unless you have little arms coming out of your chest with huge claws.
Backup armor.
So
say hello to my little arms.
Exactly. So that's one idea. Maybe
I love that one idea. I love that theory.
Yeah,
is that a T-shirt?
If you get like right up close, belly to belly,
those little arms.
If you get belly to belly with a T-Rex, it could slash the hell out of you with these arms. So that I like that because it immediately made sense to me, especially.
That's also awesome. Yeah.
Yep.
The ultimate scientific test.
But Steve, there's another one though. There's one more.
The oldest hypothesis, actually, the first hypothesis for what are they doing with these arms?
Sex, baby.
Was during copulation, during sex.
I was going to ask that.
This was a way of basically creating some kind of stability, like just holding on and. Sure. Okay. You could use your imagination. You can imagine two T-Rexes doing it, and the arms are there just for
I'm sorry to say I am using my imagination. Yeah, it's
right.
not what
Yo,
I plan to think
Yo, clip your claws, bro. Are.
Yeah. It wouldn't explain the huge, you know, claws that clearly look like weapons, but that could also be, you know, one of the utilities. And then others have proposed that, it could also be used for scavenging, you know, the arms would still be able to like rend the flesh of a corpse, maybe with a little bit more dexterity than the giant mouth would, you know, whether that would be necessary or useful or not, or would they just crunch the bones and everything all at once and just, you know, eat it up? I don't know. The problem is we can't observe these things in nature because they're not alive. Right. So we have to infer it from their morphology.
We go back in time.
Is it possible that the arms were just useless and over, if they lived longer, maybe they would have just gone away?
No. That's not a viable hypothesis because there are so many species within three groups that have these robust arms, and there was plenty of evolutionary time for them to completely go away if that were the only evolutionary forces at work. If it was just
like snakes
losing
their legs kind of thing.
Snakes, there are legless lizards. Snakes have lost their legs. Yeah. There's no reason why they wouldn't have just completely lost them if they were just in the way, if they were not being used for anything. So that's not really a viable hypothesis. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, at the risk of treading in the sex binary, is there a difference between male versus female T-Rex arms? Because I was thinking maybe it's like the claws are to show sexual prowess, you know, peacock.
So we don't have enough specimens to know. I think it's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure. I mean, is that a female T-Rex? I don't know. Yeah.
So, Steve, will they ever be able to draw new conclusions going forward, or are we at the peak of information and all we can do is assess?
We don't have that many specimens. We don't have that many specimens. So the answer is the more specimens we get, the more we will be able to test hypotheses about what they were using those arms for. There's a limit, though, to that kind of inferential evidence, right? We're never going to know for sure. I mean, it may be one of those things like if we ever did somehow observe a T-Rex in the wild, be like, oh my God, that's like completely different than what we imagined their behavior to be. Animal behavior can sometimes be surprising, and unusual. But again, if it were a one-off, I would say we have no idea, right? If it were a one-off, but because there's so many species, I think that's where we're going to be able to make some intelligent guesses about what they were using them for, because we could then start to compare. That's why there's so much room for more evidence, because we have lots of different species with very few specimens, and some are incomplete. It's like, again, they just found, this is the first time they found arms, attached to the third group, knowing that they were also tiny. And so, as we get more data, I think that we'll a more clear picture will develop as to how they were.
I'm not sure if this is like a fair question, but is there any estimate of like how many specimens are out there? Like, is it likely that there are like three more T-Rexes we'll ever find, or is that just like a completely unknown
question? To be found? Yeah, I don't.
Yeah,
I mean, I've never seen an estimate. That's an interesting question. Yeah. Somebody may have published a paper estimating how many T-Rexes are out there to be found.
Yeah, like I was thinking it's not very many. I was like, are there like thousands eventually in our future? I mean, it obviously depends on a lot of different things, but I got to become a paleontologist.
So more than 40 specimens of tyrannosaurs have been identified. I think only 40 different specimens, but not all complete. I think only a small number of them are complete. And I think that's of tyrannosaurus as a group, not tyrannosaurus rex as a species.
Right.
So that gives you some idea what we're dealing with now.
Velociraptor arms were weapons, right? I mean, I'm basing this on Jurassic Park, but I'm trying to think of other dinosaurs with arms.
Yeah. Yeah, but that group, the smaller theropods with that
the claw, the foot claw,
Deinonychus, and Velociraptor, they had that foot claw, that huge curved one toe that sticks up, and they would
nasty
get,
they would
rip your belly.
They got
open.
Newman, but good,
right.
So, Steve, I like the idea of potentially in the future finding out more details by running simulations. That's an interesting idea, how far we could take that running simulations based on, what we know about, potential DNA and the morphology as much as we know about it, and then trying to extrapolate from that and maybe get some ideas. But
it would be interesting once we get to the point where we have enough computing power and good enough software and everything where we could have virtual T-Rexes running around and we could at least see like the plausibility study. Then we could do hypothesis testing, like would this work? What would it have looked like?
Right.
Would this have created any unanticipated problems that would be a deal killer for
it? We're nowhere near that level of sophistication yet, though.
Right. That,
like what would need to be true for it to be a weapon, a secondary weapon or whatever. What kind of fun? I'm mostly thinking when you suggested the simulations, I was like, oh yeah, we'll wear those inflatable T-Rex costumes.
Oh my God, it's so
They're
so funny.
At least as a thought or as a way to proof of concept, I think might be.
Or eventually, once we get like a good neural link going, you could be a T-Rex, a virtual T-Rex, and then see how it feels, and then
unleash yourself on the plains and go hunting.
Then we'll get a good idea. So there will be virtual T-Rexes running around, if not biological ones. Or we'll make robot T-Rexes and then let them loose and see what happens.
Wow.
With AI.
I think Boston Dynamics, they should be weighing in.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You don't want to see what's in their secret chamber.
We could do this and just make them like 5 inches tall. And with it all, and make everything else to scale, and I mean some of the physics would be different, but we could still just morphologically just see how that works.
just in case they get a mind of their own and tear apart Boston. Like, how did Boston?
We made 1,000 T-Rexes to scale just to see how they would fight. And, you know.
Yeah. And it turns out the arms are very useful
at killing people.
For killing smart makers.
Yeah. 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 For disrupting the subway system.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Bombas Socks.
Bombas' mission is simple, guys. Make the most comfortable clothes ever and match every item sold with an equal item donated. So when you buy Bombas, you are also giving to someone in need.
Yeah, Bombas socks are absolutely great. They have sport performance socks made to keep your feet dry. They have no-show socks that don't fall down. They also have great-fitting t-shirts. They have really comfortable underwear, and all of these things are made from their high-end fabrics.
Go to bombas.com/skeptics and get 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/skeptics for 20% off.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Andrea, back to messy sociology. You're going to tell us about research on getting out the vote.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. This is the T-Rexes were more fun, but there's got to be a way we combine these. This is a political science paper that came out earlier this month, hot off the presses. There's no paywall at the moment. It's not gated, so you can read it yourselves. It's called Getting Out the Vote in the Projects, Lessons from a Community Organizing Experiment in the Journal Politics, Groups, and Identities. And so I like this article because it brings up a couple of really big methodological challenges in political science, and that I think, and this is maybe as hopeful as I can be, about politics are actually, if we could continue to get a better grip on these questions, we could actually maybe make our governments do something, to Jay's point that we can't really count on them, at least for steel. So one of the big things that we do in political science is try to figure out why people vote and what gets people to vote. And in the American context, it's one of the best, like, empirically studied areas in political science. A lot of field experiments in particular, but not just field experiments, on what kinds of interventions with voters get people to show up to vote. And not surprisingly, the evidence is basically like, the more involved you are, the more likely people are to vote. So sending someone something in the mail that says, yo, go vote, is less effective than showing up at their door and saying, hey, vote, which is even less effective than showing up at their door three times. There's a point after which restraining orders get involved, right? And obviously the content of these messages matters as well. So there's also interesting work that's like, you know, most of your neighbors are voting. Are you? That's different from you've got to vote, you know, shame-based versus relative behavior-based. So there's a lot. It's very well researched. But this article, this paper, points out two problems in this research. They're not the only ones to point this out, but they're one of the few to try to address the problem. One problem is that it turns out that all these interventions on balance do tend to work, in quotes, which is that as best we can tell, the effect isn't massive, but as best we can tell, all the stuff that we all hear about in the U.S. about mobilizing and canvassing and get out the vote, it tends to help. And we think that in the absence of this intervention, fewer people would vote. But most of the people that we think, and this is after decades of work, most of the people that we think are ending up voting are pretty well-off Americans. So middle class, white. This paper mostly focuses on class and race, so I'll leave it there. So basically what happens with these get out the vote campaigns is we get people who are like almost going to vote, and this can tip them into doing it. What it doesn't seem to be doing is have any effect on communities that historically do not have high participation rates. And this paper in particular focuses on the intersection of low socioeconomic class and Black Americans. So there's very little participation in voting and very little research on what might cause these folks to participate more, because most of the research, while not empirically designed to white people, tends to focus on white people, suburbs, that sort of thing. The other thing that this paper, and this part I think is a little bit harder for me to get my head around, but the other thing that they talk about is that the interventions that we've been doing and we've been studying in political science for getting out the vote have been individual or like dyadic based. So basically, I go to someone's house, I knock on the door and I say, hey, can I register you to vote? Can I get you to commit you're going to vote on? What's your plan to go vote? Like, it's one-on-one interactions. And their argument, and I don't know enough about this to say how what I think of it, but their argument is that a lot of people who don't vote, it's not an individual issue. It's that the society, the group, the community that they're in has, you know, they've grown up in a community where nobody votes. And so an intervention that bases the change in behavior on the individual is not likely to work. You have to tap into social networks, and the whole community needs to be, you need a community level intervention as opposed to an individual level. So all of this is to say, they have a nice little 2x2 matrix, and I love a 2x2 matrix. So all of this to say, this paper is a randomized experiment. They partnered with a community organizing group in Akron, Ohio, in the lead up to the 2018 midterm elections, and they started their work in 2017 and did some follow-up in 2018. They had a two-phase project. So this group was going to go into community blocks, like housing units, kind of like big sections. And this is, as randomized as political science can get, in the sense that there were six possible, like, housing developments that they could have worked in, but this organization only had the budget to intervene in two. So they used a random number generator and picked two of those six possible housing units. And so those were the treatment, and then the other four communities were the control. So it was about 300 people overall in the treatment over the two units, and about 1,000 in the control. And the treatment was, in 2017, a number of people who were not from that community but were of the same racial background and where necessary spoke the same language, if there were second languages or non-English languages, went in and held like community organizing events. So let's get together and talk about some of the problems facing our community. Let's get together and talk about what we'd like to see the local government do with respect to crime, with respect to trash, with respect to this, with respect to that, and get people talking. And there was nothing about the election. It was just like, let's talk about the governance of this community and let's see what we would like changed. That was in 2017. And that was the treatment. In 2018, the organization sent people to do the one-on-one get out the vote work in all six. So the treatment and the control all supposedly got the same, like, hey, don't forget to register to vote. So the whole experiment got registered to vote. And in the end, it turned out that there was a 3 percentage point difference, something like 17% of the community in the treatment group went to vote in the midterm elections, and 14% in the control group voted in the elections. And one of the frustrating takeaways, one is that's not a huge gap, but on the other hand, thinking about American elections, that's a big difference.
Yeah, that would make a big difference.
So that's something big, right? So it's both depressing, but also matters. The other thing, and this I'm really interested to hear you all, what you think about this, because it's something that I think we've talked about before, is it's not statistically significant. That's the reason, is because the sample size is tiny. To get a study with like the kind of like statistical power that you would need at you know, a 0.05 level or anything that you would want, you need something like 80 housing units is what they said. So they're not even close. Like the number of people and the amount of work that would need to be done to actually do a potentially, you know, powerful enough experiment is huge. And we don't really have the budget or resources for that in political science usually. And community organizations don't really have that. So we don't have a statistically significant result. That said, statistical significance is, you know, not the only thing that we care about when we think about results, but it is something that I think puts a big damper on excitement that might be generated from this study. So they also did a bunch of qualitative research, and because I'm a huge snob, I was like, I guess, but I don't really, I mean, I care. And they were like, the focus groups were consistent with our hypothesis, and that's good, but I don't feel quite as moved by that, but don't tell the authors I said that part. So community level organizing, I know a lot of people, I was thinking of Kara as well when I was reading this, because I know that she's very, very involved in community organizing. I have a lot of family members who are, and I was like, okay, it feels good that maybe this makes a difference. There's still a ton more work to do. This is way less carefully studied than the T-Rex arms, just in the sense that this is the only study of its kind that specifically is in this particular community level gap that focuses on the intersection of black and lower below middle class. So it's one of the first projects, but it's encouraging, but it also, I think, highlights how hard it is to do these kinds of, like, I think, rigorous scientific studies in the real world, never mind in an ethical way, right? Because you're affecting real elections. You're not just, working in a lab.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my one of the things I'm wondering from you all is, the statistical significance deal breaker, and also just like political science research, how it's so messy and it's so difficult. And there's a million other things that we couldn't possibly control for in these field experiments. And, I'm both excited about it, but I also realize its limitations.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to say that because it wasn't statistically significant, we don't know if the result is real or not. There may be reasons to think that you know, it's consistent. There was a dose response, whatever. There's other things you could bring into bear to say that it's the trend is probably a real effect, but you don't really know.
Right.
But it does tell you that if there is a real effect, it's small. Although, as you say, small effects can tip elections because, you know, if it's a close election, doesn't mean it's not impactful, but it just, objectively speaking, magnitude wise, it's a small effect. That's why you need a really powerful study to see it statistically. But it is, you know, it does make sense also just from, you know, what I know about just the psychological research to begin with, that the hey, your neighbors are voting approach is the one that works the best. The sort of social norming approach. Yeah, the shaming kind of negative thing doesn't really work, generally speaking.
At least in
medicine, like shaming people into doing stuff is counterproductive, actually.
Scared straight.
But social norming, like using social, scared straight doesn't work. Social pressure does work, although modestly. Yeah. That's the other thing, is that the effects are mild. It's hard to change people's behavior. It's, you know, to just decide you're going to make people do something and then to change it. When you're going against the stream, you know,
the streams.
You know, meaning like, for example, like getting people to quit smoking, all the things that we do have a teeny effect and we're kind of debating. Like nibbling around the edges, like we're debating, oh, this method had a 6% response rate as opposed to a 3% response rate. It's like, yeah, but it's still just an abysmal 6% response. You would think that someone saying, hey, you should stop doing this or you're going to die, you know, would have a huger impact, but it doesn't.
The black lungs on the
it just doesn't work.
So for voting,
I mean, I guess you got to find out what's the hook, right? Just saying, oh, you're...
Right.
Country's going to hell if you don't vote. That's not going to do it, probably.
Right. Well, and the argument in this paper is that these are communities in particular, the hypothesis, kind of the sub-hypothesis here, or the assumption under which we're operating is these are communities that are long since, you know, the discouraged voters, basically, of America, which is like the types of, you know, anecdotes that they're saying in these conversations are like, nothing has ever changed. I've been living here for a million years. I've never seen the government try to help me once. Like, why would I suddenly start voting? Like, I haven't voted my whole life. I'm not going. And everyone around you thinks that. So this study was like, we've got to change the broader, you know, not just tell them that other people around you are voting, but kind of do this community level intervention to change the very view of the efficacy of voting, which is a massive undertaking. And I also am skeptical that the treatment, which is a handful of town hall meetings, is actually going to do, you know, maybe a different type of intervention would have been different. Maybe an actual politician showing up and working. I don't know.
They would probably have to see a really positive change happening. You're right. That cynicism is defeatist. And that is hard. That is hard to work against. That is the kind of thing that we have to be careful of, you know, as skeptics, because it is easy to slide into defeatism of saying like, oh, nothing we do is going to move the needle on global warming. It's done. You know, it's like, even if I think that that's true, I'm not going to accept it as true because it's self-defeating. And first of all, you don't know that it's true. You know, it's just it's a guess. But why have a subjective opinion that is self-defeating?
Yeah.
But it's hard. That is hard.
Sort of my environmental microeconomics professor in grad school, super classical microeconomics, you know, neoliberal. He was like, you need a no regrets policy, which is like, let's do it and then hope it made life better, even if it turns out we didn't need to do it. And I think, Steve, what you're talking about is that, where it's like, okay, maybe nothing we do is going to make a difference, but what's something we can do that even if it doesn't make a difference is probably still for the better, like pollute less or,
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's an approach I take a lot to, like, in medical interventions. It's like, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but you should do it anyway. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if losing weight is going to reduce your migraines, but you probably want to lose weight anyway. And just as an example or whatever, or, you know, let's treat your neck pain, or let's improve your sleep. Let's do the things that are good for you anyway. And there's whether or not we can scientifically prove, you know, to a rigorous degree that it absolutely will address your other issue. It's kind of a win-win. So why not do it? So yeah, you get, there's that sort of pragmatic thing of let's get people involved and let's, you know, you probably should deal with the underlying conspiracy theories that are feeding the nihilism anyway. And we could figure, sort out later whether or not it gets people to actually vote. You know, obviously we're interested in knowing that, but it's a positive intervention, even if it fails.
Right.
You can look at it that way.
Yeah, there's no harm.
Right. Right. We hope, right? I mean, I don't know exactly what these community organizers said, but my sense is that I sort of trusted them to do something that was not harmful. You could imagine, though, the shame-based ones could be more
harmful.
They could
be.
When you get the IRB involved, right, where you start shaming people. And there was some study or some effort to – because you can publish who voted. And so there were like threats in one study, right, where they're like, if you don't go vote, we're going to tell your neighbors that you didn't vote. And it was like, this is surely unethical.
All right, Bob, tell us about the latest James Webb images. These are all over the place.
Well, it's nothing, you know.
Next.
Well, yes, Steve, this was the week for the James Webb Space Telescope. It was absolutely all over the news, and that's because its first images were released to the public, and oh boy, are they magnificent. Now, I scoured my brain for moments to come up with the perfect geeky references for this specific news item, and I came up with a couple. Now witness the power of this fully operational space telescope. And this one's for Jay. My God. Let's finish it, Jay.
It's full of stars.
Yes, it's full of stars.
Full of more stars.
Very good, Jay. That specific quote was in the book for 2001 A Space Odyssey, not in the movie. But it was in the 2010 sequel. So, 2010.
Yes.
So, I love that this astronomy news just seemed to capture so much attention. Countless articles, TV, web news items, blogs, memes all over the place. And then the President of the United States essentially releases the first full color image from James Webb at a public event at the White House. And it just made me feel so good. Clearly, James Webb Space Telescope is a bona fide cultural phenomenon. At least it really seemed this week and maybe last December when it launched. The worldwide enthusiasm, it makes me emotional this past week to see the love out there. I wish we'd see this level of interest more often. It makes me think of that episode of Sliders, going back a little, where they went to an Earth where scientists were heroes, where science was worshipped. It was like, I want to go there. So now it's especially good timing now for me. Now with so many things in the United States and all over the planet going horribly wrong, my God, in ways that I would not have even anticipated just not too long ago. And so it made me feel better, if for just a few minutes. Now let's start with this magnificent image that President Biden revealed. And he revealed it on my mom's 85th birthday. And Steve and Jay, your mom's too.
Yeah.
July 11th.
Amazing.
Hope you remembered to call
one
one.
One day ahead of the rest of these, the first images that were released this past week. So this first image that everybody saw was that deep space image that showed thousands and thousands of galaxies. Cool. This was James Webb's first deep field image, which is essentially an extreme zoom in a galaxy cluster, showing the faintest infrared objects, galaxies ever seen, perhaps some of them more than 13 billion light years away. And consider this, it took the telescope 12 and a half hours to create that image, and it was far sharper and deeper than what Hubble had produced when it tried to create it over weeks.
Yeah, I heard a month.
Like three weeks or even a month. This James Webb knocked it out in 12 and a half hours. And that's just the first one. That one's going to be updated soon.
You should look at like individual galaxies in that image. I know you take
Oh my God.
Gestalt. But spend some time zooming in and looking, because they're beautiful. There are so many gorgeous. But I think the one that gets
all
the attention.
Over every image.
There's
every
like
image.
The pancake galaxy, like that seems to be wobbly.
One line.
Yeah.
Gravitational lensing.
But I wonder, is that the shape of the galaxy, or is that gravitational lensing?
Which one? Wait, which one do you mean wobbly?
Well, it's like you're seeing it almost on its edge, and it looks like it's wavy. Like the from the side, the galaxy's wavy. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, But that, I'm not familiar with that specific one, but that could be the byproduct. That wave could be the byproduct of a close encounter with a nearby galaxy. In fact, the Milky Way has such a wave. It might not be as overt as the one you're talking about,
yeah.
But we have detected waves in the Milky Way caused by close encounters with other galaxies. But I don't know that one specifically, so I won't say any more about it.
You don't
but
have the image up this. In front of you?
I got 70 tabs open here, man. But I did find a super high res version and was jumping around.
There's also a lot of like arcs of light in that image, and again, I wonder, is that an artifact of James Webb? Is that like gravitational lensing?
No, effect? there's absolutely gravitational lensing going on, because that galaxy cluster that first image was a zoom in on. Was also acted as a gravitational lens for some of those more distant galaxies behind it. So you will definitely be seeing some odd shapes caused by the gravitational lensing. But I will go to a Bill Nelson, NASA administrator, quote that I liked. He said, Webb's first deep field is not only the first color image from the James Webb Space Telescope, it's the deepest and sharpest infrared image of the distant universe so far. Mm. This image covers a patch of sky approximately the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length. It's just a tiny sliver of the vast universe. This mission was made possible by human ingenuity, the incredible NASA Webb team, and our international partners at the European Space Agency and Canadian Space Agency. Webb is just the start of what we can accomplish in the future when we work together for the benefit of humanity. So that's a great quote.
Beautiful.
From Bill Nelson, much better than his quote about China last week, blah, blah, blah. All right, so next image, I'll discuss the planetary nebula called the Southern Ring Nebula, 2,500 light years away. Beautiful, beautiful image. Now, of course, planetary nebula, I have to say, yet again, is a misnomer. It has nothing to do with planets in any way. These are intermediate mass stars at the end of their years of fusion that have ejected layers of gas during its giant phase, and then that gas spreads out into beautiful patterns for millennia, you know, about 10,000 years. So this is a brief period where this planetary nebula is so gorgeous. And another, whatever, 5,000-6,000 years, it's going to be too diffuse to even really see. So they are very brief and beautiful. This ring nebula is especially special because it's binary. The fainter one, the fainter star that you can just kind of barely see, that's the one that released all the gas. And its brighter partner, because it's in orbit, it helped stir up the beautiful patterns in the gas
cool.
that James Webb reveals like it's never been revealed before. Really love that image. One of my favorites of those that were released were of the five galaxies called Stefan's Quintet, which you remember. You may remember seeing them. I bet you all of us have seen these galaxies before, because if you have seen It's a Wonderful Life, then you have seen those galaxies. Remember, like 2 minutes into the movie, those goofy angels are talking and they light up, the galaxies light up depending on which angel is talking. Mm-hmm. That was Stefan's Quintet. That's what those galaxies were, which was an awesome find. I'm like, oh my God, that's right. I remember that. And if you go back to the image that they used of Stefan's Quintet, God, when was that movie made? In the 50s? In the 40s? The image is, you know, it's clearly Stefan's Quintet, but it's horrible, of course, because it was made, you know, 70, 80 years ago. They didn't have James Webb or even the Hubble back then. So the image is horrible, especially compared to what was just released now. So, yeah, these are beautiful. Check these out. Zoom in on these. The quintet is actually more of a quartet of gravitationally interacting galaxies. Two of them are seriously merging. They're so far into the merge that one is called blah 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 A and the other one's called blah 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 B. 7802053B, whatever. They are 280 million light years away, and they are merging at 2 million miles per hour. And so the Webb images shows in detail how this merger triggers star formation within these galaxies. And that's because when galaxies merge, stars aren't hitting each other. It's all about the vast amounts of gas that are smacking together. And that's what creates all the star formation that James Webb Telescope is now seeing in unprecedented detail. Beautiful, beautiful images. And then, so what's going on? What's going to happen in the near future? Well, I think we may already, or we will very soon have another deep field that will have even more, even more clarity and higher resolution than what we saw on July 11th. And I hope, if you remember my talk, was it 2 or 3 weeks ago, I talked about how these deep field images from Hubble helped us estimate that there may be 6 to 20 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. Yeah. I hope they use this new, whatever new image that James Webb comes up with to refine that and get it down. Is it closer to 6 trillion galaxies, or is it closer to 20 trillion, or is it even more than 20 trillion? So I think that will help us find out how many galaxies there are in the observable universe. In the next 6 months, we'll see results from what's called the early release science programs. These were programs created especially for Webb to be released, within the first six or 12 months of Webb, James Webb Telescope being activated. And that's going to include studies of the solar system, galaxies, intergalactic space, massive black holes, and more. Also, James Webb will be looking at Jupiter and its satellites like Europa. Mm. They'll be studied. And of course, it's going to be looking at exoplanets like, for example, those famous ones in the TRAPPIST-1 system. Ooh. 40 light years away. That's where they found 7 planets in orbit around a dim dwarf star. Oh, yeah. 3 of them are Earth-sized, and they're orbiting in the habitable zone.
Sure.
James Webb already found clear signatures of what, using his spectrographic equipment, water in a hot Jupiter. Fascinating stuff. So if you haven't already, like we've said, go online, look at the larger versions.
Yeah, you got to get the
versions you can find. Super high res. Wait 10 minutes. Get a cup of coffee while it downloads. Just download it and then just zoom in, click around, and you see, oh, look at this. This little tiny blob of light, when I zoom in, is this gorgeous spiral galaxy. And you could look at any image, look at any of the images that I talked about, and just zoom in and you will see background, very faint background images of more and more galaxies that have never been seen before. They're stunning. And these are just the first batch. I've heard them compared to, Steve, when you get your first, you get your new fancy new camera and you're doing your test pictures and you're using mostly the default settings.
Oh.
That's what James Webb has done. These are are essentially the default settings. In the future,
we're
going to see.
It's not optimized yet?
I mean, not fully optimized. Yeah. Sure, they tweaked them, and they did a lot of marketing research, and they made, because this batch was very important because this was the initial release, They succeeded very well. But in the future, we're going to see more images and data, not just pretty pictures, but amazing data that really push the envelope what James Webb Space Telescope can accomplish. So it's going to be a hell of a ride for the next couple of decades.
Yes.
For the James Webb Space Telescope.
Woo-hoo. Awesome.
Literally, we need something good going on. That's great.
Tell me about it.
Yes, I know.
Love it.
Can I read something on Twitter right before we started that made me angry that was about this? Can I bring the mood down slightly?
Yes,
I want to hear your take on it.
Deniers? What is it? James Webb deniers?
I think I know what it is.
It's all fake. This is
right.
I did
like
hear
moon landing hoaxer.
Or they're not impressed.
Yeah, someone compared, someone named Seth Rudin, I think, on Twitter, compared the big galaxy picture to the carpets in bowling alleys, and I thought that was hilarious. But that's not the thing that made me mad. They're like, bowling alleys nailed it in the 90s. What made me angry was someone who's an expert in this field was tweeting about the pictures and talking about what a monumental achievement and all this great stuff, much like what we were just talking about here. And then someone started, clamoring and quote tweeting and saying all these things like, yeah, but when are we going to talk about real issues like climate change and poverty and pandemics?
Oh, my God.
We run into that often. That old canard.
Yep,
yeah. And I was like, oh, what a party killer, Jesus. And it's like, I kind of get where he's coming from, but on the other hand, I was like, how can you see these as zero sum, right? Like, I mean, this is like the wonder and all the amazing parts of being human, and surely whatever technology we learn from this can eventually help us all live better, whatever, I don't know. But I got very upset about it. I'm curious what the skeptics' take is on, because they're not wrong, these are problems, and you could imagine the money being spent on more earthly concerns.
I hate that.
We can do multiple things at the same time.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
It's often like the logical fallacy of relative privation. It's like, we have to focus all our attention on what I think is the single most important thing, or there's always going to be something more important. That doesn't mean we can't do anything if we're not curing cancer in kids. It's ridiculous.
Right.
you know, by the end of this year, there will be 8 billion people on this planet.
Yeah,
they
that's
could do
right.
A lot of stuff at the same time. You know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, with platforms like this, here's one example where, I mean, a lot of this is just pure science and it's pure information.
Right.
And we need to be in love with just the idea of basic research that has no immediate benefit. Mm-hmm. But how about some of the immediate potential benefits? Like, for example, using platforms, maybe not like James Webb, but other platforms that can say, oh, look, this asteroid's going to hit us in 20 years. Let's save 8 billion people with this knowledge that we got from this from this technology. Right. We could potentially save the entire planet.
Right.
Let's, you know, I mean, so there is some nice stuff that can actually have immediate impact on people besides just like, ooh, look at that cool picture.
Right.
Oh, my God.
And I imagine, you know, I also felt great seeing this and reading, you know, the quote that you read was, you know, various agencies, international government got together. We worked together. It's human cooperation. It made me feel united as a species. Like the whole, I think the morale means a lot as well. I think that shouldn't be discounted. It's going to make me vote, you know, all this stuff.
Well, everyone, I'm going to take a quick break to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Wondrium.
Wondrium has a video for pretty much anything you want to learn about. Also, the Wondrium videos, they're all well-produced and they're presented by top university professors and experts. You should definitely go to their website and check out the huge list of things you can learn about.
All right, guys, I'm checking out their new course, Concepts at the Edge of Modern Physics. It is fascinating. It's done by Dr. Benjamin Schumacher, professor of physics, which is the kind of guy you would need for this. The chapter titles alone are just so intriguing. How about this one? Maxwell's Demon. You know what that is? It involves a demon, but it also involves entropy. There's also predicting the future, but it's not about jetpacks. It's about something even more fantastic called dynamical chaos. There's also chapters on faster than light, impossible exactness, the future of the impossible. I can't wait to get through this. It is just so addictive, and you're going to love it too, I bet.
We want you to unlock this world of knowledge for yourself as well. So sign up for Wondrium today and take advantage of this great offer that Wondrium is offering SGU listeners. A free trial plus 20% off the annual plan. To get this offer, you need to visit their special URL, wondrium.com/skeptics. Again, that's wondrium.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
All right, guys, last time I played this noisy. All right, so you hear a horrible horn sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And people always say bagpipes.
Yeah, it is bagpipish.
Someone will say bagpipes.
So broken many, bagpipes. Many people said bagpipes. But the first person to send one in was Sarah Mangham. And she said, I think this kind of sounds like a bagpipe, but maybe being played with helium. That is not correct. There are no bagpipes destroyed in this Who's That Noisy.
But now I want to hear bagpipes played with helium.
Oh, same. That has to exist.
A listener named Shane Hillier wrote in, said, hi, Jay, this week sounds like a group of horn players trying to do a shepherd tone.
Whoa.
For those of you who don't know what a shepherd tone is, it is a ascending or descending tone that seems to go on forever, but they play a trick on your mind when they do it, because as the notes are going up, there's lower notes that are taking over, and it just really does feel like it just keeps going up and up and up. It's pretty cool. Look it up if you haven't heard it and take a listen.
We played it on the show before. That's what I thought too. It has that vibe, that it's like that the forever escalating scale, you know, that illusion, that auditory illusion.
Yeah.
But but I know we've had that on the show before.
So another listener wrote in, Gerald H., and he said, this is the song of sirens leading seamen to their deaths. That is not correct, although if you do listen to those horns as much as I have recently, you will probably die.
Wow.
Yeah, because they're not pleasant to hear. Ashley Zink, Z-I-N-Y-K, right? Zing?
No cool help name. There?
Yep. Sounds good to you. Hi, Jay. I think this week's noise is a pipe organ starting up. The blower takes a while to fill the whole machine with pressurized air. That's interesting. And that is also incorrect. And we have a winner for this week. Name is Jeremy C. He said, hi, Jay and Rogues. I believe this week's Noisy is taken from Tom Scott's video on gravity-fed decorative water fountains. And that is absolutely correct. Now, this is coming from Stephen Tuscan, who initially wrote in. So here's the explanation, though. 300 years ago, rich German aristocrats were known to spend some of their wealth on something called water features. I had never heard about this. So water features were, you know, giant fountains, big bodies of water or something along those lines. And some of them were built in a way where when, like, let's say there's a waterfall type of thing happening on the property, they could use that pressure to do different things, to have a fountain, or they could have air blow out of horns, right? You know, because they very cleverly built it so as the water is coming down, it creates air pressure, and then they blow that air out of the horns. So that was it. So basically, there was a lot of really rich people in Germany who spent a lot of their extra money on very, very expensive gardens and, you know, these water features, like, you know, basically just, you know, making their yards, their giant yards look amazing and have all these cool things. So thank you very much for sending that Noisy in. I had never heard of any of this, which is why life is so freaking interesting. I have a new Noisy this week. This Noisy was sent in by a listener named Robert House. And here it is. Okay, so something is happening in this video, in this audio. It was a video, but I took the audio from. So there is something happening. That's my clue. If you think you know what this week's Noisy is, or you heard something really cool, please do. Just send it to me. You never know. I might love it. Send it to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Hey, if you haven't considered, why don't you consider becoming a patron of the SGU? We have a Patreon. We have some very interesting levels on there and different things, awards that you can get if you become a patron. But, you know, most of all, what you'll be doing is just helping support the continuation of this podcast. We are in our, what, 17th year, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time.
We completed 17 years. We're in our 18th year.
We're in our 18th wow. year, over 850 episodes.
888.
But if you do get 88, you're right. And if you do get anything out of this show and you appreciate the work that we do, please go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and become a patron. You could join our Discord. We have a thriving Discord community with tons of awesome people in there and lots of perks in there as well.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Evan, you have a quote quiz for this week.
I do. The return of the quote quiz, Potent Quotables, the game in which I challenge my fellow rogues to guess the quote. I'm going to give them three choices. I'm going to say the quote, and then they're going to have a multiple choice, three choices to decide which one, which person, which character, which whomever said that quote. Andrea, are you ready to play this game?
I've never been more ready. Let's do it. I'm ready to Google all these quotes. No, I'm not going to do it. Yeah.
Okay. So we have a mix of different sort of, you know, themes in a sense, but then there's five quotes in total. The first quote is comes from Star Trek, so I'll give you that heads up.
All right.
Here is the quote. Compassion, that's the one thing no machine ever had. Maybe it's the one thing that keeps men ahead of them. Was that quote uttered by A, Dr. Leonard McCoy, B, Dr. Phil Boyce, or C, Dr. Phlox?
Well, I think... Yeah, okay.
Go ahead, Andrea, you start. And I'm going to be keeping score for you, by the way. So
okay, great. Well, this is going to be very easy for you because now is where I'll just see myself off the show because I have never seen Star Trek. So So I'm going to go with B.
Andrea, you're dead to me.
I know, I'm sorry. There's a lot of science fiction I like. I just like somehow missed a lot of big ones as well. So
you're young. There's still time.
Yeah, I was going to say, the good news is you get to watch all of Star Trek for the first time.
There we go.
Oh, that's lucky.
That's silver lining. Yes. I'm going to hang up right now and go do it. Yeah. Then, Evan, I'll call you with my answer to the quote quiz.
Yes. So you'll get back to me on that one.
Yeah. A couple years.
All right. So which one?
So B, just because it's in the middle.
Okay, B because it's in the middle.
And the third one sounded like a fake name. It sounded like a flax. I don't know. I'm probably thinking everyone.
Those are three doctors that have been.
Are they all real people? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right. No, they are characters.
Real there have fictional been characters. Yeah.
Several fictional doctors characters. That have been on, okay. on the various Star Trek series. All right, Steve, let's run to you. A, B, or
I
C,
mean, but... it sounds like a Bones McCoy quote, but I don't recognize it, so I'm going to say Dr. Phlox.
Okay, Dr. Phlox. And let's go to Jay.
Yeah, I think I would remember McCoy saying that, so I'll say Phlox as well.
And Bob.
My exact reasoning is the two previous schmucks.
Yeah, I should have said Phlox.
And the answer is Dr. Leonard McCoy.
Oh, from, man.
No
from
way.
The episode,
what episode?
The Ultimate Computer.
Compassion?
Yep.
Yeah, I was thinking of that episode, actually.
Yep. Yeah, that
I just
would
didn't
be
remember
the one.
That quote. I haven't seen
Compassion.
It.
Compassion.
So, yeah,
I
have
should what have known that.
Oh, that's a good one. I
blame myself.
I'm pleasantly surprised. Let's move on to the second quote. Here we all go. Right, this I'm skeptics,
I'm,
okay?
I'm too embarrassed to go
famous
on.
Famous skeptics. Here we go. Ideas have consequences, and totally erroneous ideas are likely to have destructive consequences. Who said that? Was it A, James Randi, B, Steve Allen, or C, Isaac Asimov? And we're going to start with Steve on this one.
Say it again.
You need the names again or you need the quote again?
No, the quote again.
Ideas have consequences, and totally erroneous ideas are likely to have destructive consequences.
I'll say Randi.
Okay. Jay?
That sounds like Randi to me.
It does sound like Randi, so there's Jay. Bob?
The third one was Asimov?
Yes, it was.
I got to go with Asimov.
Okay, and Andrea?
Yeah, I originally was like, oh, this is a Steve Novella quote, but that's not fair for this game, so
they,
I'm going to go
They
Asimov.
Stole it from me, so.
Yeah. As paraphrased from, I'm going to go Asimov as well, because he's awesome.
Asimov as well, and the answer is B, Steve Allen, from his book, More Steve Allen on the Bible, Religion, and Morality.
Wow, man. He
Are
was,
we
he
all
was
zero
good,
for
man.
Zero?
Yeah.
Yes, I know. Isn't that exciting?
Zero for two.
Yeah, well done.
That's fine. Yeah. That means I'm winning.
Exactly. We have a tie.
Yeah, perfect.
We have three tiebreaker questions, in effect. All right, here's the third one. This is Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize is this theme. Telomeres are the protective caps at the ends of chromosomes in cells. Chromosomes carry the genetic information. Telomeres are buffers. They are like the tips of shoelaces. If you lose the tips, the ends start fraying. Who said that? Was it Nobel Prize winner Francis Arnold, Nobel Prize winner Elizabeth Blackburn, or Nobel Prize winner Jennifer Doudna? Let's start with Jay.
I think it was the third person.
Doudna, Jennifer Doudna. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Bob.
Doudna.
Let's go to Andrea.
I'm tempted by Doudna, but I'm gonna go Francis Arnold.
And Steve.
I'm gonna say Blackburn, just so one of us gets a point. Yeah. I was gonna say Blackburn anyway, but that's all the more reason.
And the answer is Elizabeth Blackburn. Blackburn won the Nobel Prize in 2009 for her research on anti-aging, in particular on the benefits of lengthening telomeres. Francis Arnold was co-winner of the prize, directed evolution of enzymes. And Jennifer Doudna, co-winner for her research with CRISPR technologies. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's CRISPR. I knew
CRISPR.
That.
CRISPR.
Yeah.
All right, fourth quote. Here we go. This one we'll call pseudoscience. Here's the quote. 80% of the extra virgin olive oil that you buy every day in your supermarket isn't the real deal. It may even be fake. Who said that? Was it A, Dr. Mehmet Oz, B, Gwyneth Paltrow, or C, Vonnie Harry, the food babe?
Yes, they all said it.
Yes, to all.
They quoted each other as references, yeah.
We're going to go to Bob first for this one.
The first one? Oh, wait, you said Oz is the first one?
Oz is first. Gwyneth Paltrow is second. Second is Gwyneth Paltrow. Third is the food babe.
Gwyneth.
And Andrea?
Yeah, we're going straight Gwyneth on this one. I already referenced Goop earlier. I'm in the hole.
Yeah, right.
Steve?
Even before you said the names, my initial reaction was Vonnie Harry, the food babe.
Vonnie Harry. And Jay?
I really think it's the food babe.
Food Babe. And the answer is Dr. Mehmet Oz.
Oh, my effing God.
Uncanny at missing the answer.
I didn't realize that extra virgin olive oil was the scam. It was like this thing. Like people have apparently there's this idea that it's not extra virgin olive oil, or it's not real olive oil, or it's this controversial thing.
I've read that, and you know, I've done a little bit of research into it, and it seems to be a legitimate claim. I don't know about the 80%, but it seems to be a legitimate issue.
What is it? Is it not olives? It's not virgin? It's not extra virgin?
Yeah, there are several things wrong with it, right? The 80%. That it's not olives, first of all, that there's other oils and other either impurities or whatever else going in there. You know, plus, you know, just not what it, again, not what it's not what it's advertised or claiming to be. So that may be worthy of a little deep dive in a future episode. But yeah, I'd never heard that one before. All right, the last one. Steve, you are in the lead. With one.
Wow.
So now's the time, everyone. Here we go. And
tie it up.
I hope everyone gets this one. All right.
Oh,
Movies. Here's the quote. The neutrinos are mutating into a new kind of nuclear particle. Was that uttered by the Doctor from Doctor Who, the movie? B. Dr. Santham Sirtani from 2012, or C, Lieutenant Commander Geordi LaForge, Star Trek Nemesis. Andrea, you get to wrap it up.
Well, I've at least seen Doctor Who, so I'm going to go Doctor Who.
Okay. Steve?
I know that Geordi LaForge could see neutrinos, and based entirely on that, I'm going to say Geordi LaForge.
Okay. Jay?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Geordi LaForge. I mean, it just sounds like something that he'd say. Like, you know, like Star Trek, The Next Generation had, I think, pretty mediocre technobabble. And this is a very, like, silly-sounding thing that seems like it came from Next Gen.
All right, Bob, final guess. Go for it.
So you're saying, though, that Geordi from the movie Nemesis?
Yep.
Yeah, there's a reason why I only saw that once. so disappointing. I do know that Geordi can see neutrinos, but that was from a Next Gen episode. I'd have no memory of that from Nemesis then, but I don't remember much from that movie. Yeah, what the hell? I'll go with Geordi.
Okay, Geordi. And the answer is Dr. Santham Sirtani from the movie 2012.
Forget it.
Did we all get that wrong again?
It's considered one of the silliest, most ridiculous quotes, even for a science fiction movie.
I thought about it. I mean, that I enjoyed the hell out of that movie. That was like the epic disaster movie.
Disaster movie porn is basically
it. It really was.
Yeah, is what it was.
But what was the context of that statement? I don't remember because... Something about the core of the Earth.
That's right.
Yeah.
They took samples from the core of the Earth, and they were comparing the neutrinos. And over the course of a couple days or something, they said that they were mutating because they were starting to interact with actual physical material.
I mean, they do oscillate between different types of neutrinos, but there's still a neutrino, and it still doesn't interact with like light years of matter. It would go right through without interacting. So the fact that it could change so fundamentally is silly, but what the hell? It's a damn disaster movie, and a good one too. Just with that weird techno babble. I'll stop talking now.
The winner of the winner of the quiz is Steve
with one point.
With 1 point. well done, Steve.
I'm just flabbergasted at how poorly we played it, though.
They were kind of obscure.
It wasn't that. You had good deceptive answers in most of them.
Yeah, that's all, you know, and Steve, you prep science or fiction so much, it's finding the ones that aren't right, you know, either making up the fiction or, you know, finding the incorrect ones. That's often the challenge, is to make them sound plausible, even though they are wrong.
All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real, 1 fictitious, and I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just 3 news items this week. Are you all ready?
Yes.
Yep.
Ready?
All right. Ready. Here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that smart thermostats designed to save energy through efficiency can increase strain on the electricity grid and worsen peak demand. Item number two. Researchers find that intranasal oxytocin is effective in improving emotional sensitivity and relationship satisfaction in couples undergoing therapy. And item number three, a new analysis finds that the probability of one or more human casualties from rocket body re-entry is about 10% over the next decade. All right, GA, go first.
All right, the one about smart thermostats. The claim here is that they can increase strain on the electric grid and worsen peak demand. Well, I would imagine that they are using more electricity than the old school ones just because there's, you know, a lot more, you know, processing happening. I think that's possible. But I don't think that's what you're talking about because you're saying it can increase strain on the electricity grid and worsen peak demand. That might be have something to do with the fact that they're programmable. So, you know, maybe it's like, you know, they're changing the temperatures in people's houses as the day goes on because they could do it. They can make changes on their own or you can program it. I think that's plausible at the very least. Let me go on to the next one. This intranasal oxytocin. Steve, what exactly does oxytocin do?
Well, if you knew that. I mean, I'll give this to you. It's the love hormone, right? It's the one that gets released when you are in love when women are having babies, you know, it's, yeah. So that's why people would study it for this purpose.
I mean, I think that this one's plausible as well. And to cut to the chase, the last one here, about 10% rocket body reentry is about 10% over the next decade. I just don't think that. I think 10% is way too high. People getting hit with debris. So I think that one is the fiction.
Wait.
Okay. What do you mean? Wait?
Okay.
Shut up.
Okay. I just misinterpreted number three, so I'm glad Jay said that.
All right. Okay, Evan.
Oh, boy. The smart thermostats. Yeah, they're designed to save energy, but can increase the strain on the electricity grid and worsen peak demand. Under what circumstances, though? User error. That's always a factor in anything having to do with technology. People are not using their smart thermostats right, setting them correctly. You know, whatever. I think the human element involved in that equation could certainly overcome any designs that the unit had to save energy. So I think that one's right. The other one I'm feeling, oh boy, it's down to the other two, isn't it? The rocket one. Yes, 10% seems like super high. We never hear about people getting hit with falling debris from space, and there's probably a good reason for that. But if this were to be science, that means they're anticipating an enormous, I think, increase in rocket activity over the course of the next decade. And is that the case? I mean, is it going to go up so much so that tips it to that level? I don't know, but there is a lot of activity. But then they're using, you know, rockets that return, you know, and land themselves and things. So that's a real tough one. But this intranasal oxytocin, improving emotional sensitivity. So it's like a nasal spray? Is that how this works? Okay.
Yeah. It's just a drug delivery system. That's how it gets absorbed.
So, yikes. I will say the oxytocin one's the fiction. It's not being used for therapy. It's not, right? That's got to be the part then that's not correct in some capacity. Okay. That's it.
Okay, Bob.
All right. So the thermostat one, I could see that, especially if you've got some kind of like, programmable, you know, synchronization going on with lots of them syncing up at the same time. Like, oh, when the sun sets in this time zone, switch it to this. I could see that. The third one, the casualties from rocket body reentry. Yeah, I mean, if you do, I mean, what's that? You know, the risk per year is, you know, much lower. But, I mean, that's possible, I guess. But the one, the oxytocin one potentially is problematic. I think it, I'll kind of like take a chance and say that it may be a blood-brain barrier problem that would make this one fiction.
Ooh.
Mm. All right, Andrew, so you got Jay for right. the rockets, Bob and Evan for the oxytocin. What do you say?
Right. Well, if I were smart, I would do the Steve Novella strategy of picking the one no one has picked yet.
It worked. Worked last time.
I think the energy one makes sense to me. So the rocket body reentry, I also thought 10% seemed high, but maybe it's my optimism that there'll be lots of cool space stuff going on and we do find ways to kill ourselves. So I think maybe 10% isn't too high. The oxytocin one gives me pause because I'm aware of like intranasal treatments. I've been following like intranasal ketamine as a treatment, and I could easily see this being an article in like Psychology Today, which I don't know if that's the best basis for science versus fiction. But the part that I'm hung up on is improving emotional sensitivity. Like I guess you could measure it. I don't quite know what it means, and it kind of feels like an exaggeration of a claim. So I wanted to go there, but, and maybe this is unfair, I think I am going to say the thermostat one is fiction, just to be strategic about
Ooh.
It.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, so since you're our guest, I'll save you for last. We'll take these in reverse order. We'll start with number three. Okay. A new analysis finds that the probability of one or more human casualties from rocket body reentry is about 10% over the next decade. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Jay. So yeah, this is a lot. And the thinking was prior to this that the chance of anyone getting hit by a rocket reentry was negligible, right? That it was literally negligible. But there's a few trends happening, and the big one is just a dramatic increase in the number of rockets that we're sending up. But also, you know, there's increases in the world population as well. There's more people around.
8 billion people.
Yep, we're going to hit 8 billion by the end of the year. So they ran the numbers again. They go, you know what? It's actually a lot higher than we thought. And the probability was 10% basically over the next decade. The problem is with uncontrolled rocket reentry. You know, you have like a multi-stage rocket and the parts that don't get into orbit are almost in orbit, but you know, it decays and they're low enough in the atmosphere that they come down to the ground, but there's absolutely no control over where they come down. Right. They don't try to control the reentry in any way. Cause that would basically require that you have a rocket on that piece with a little bit of fuel enough to deorbit it in a controlled fashion. That's the standard that we're going for. We want all rockets to have controlled deorbiting of any of their stages that are, you know, are not getting put into full orbit. But it's more expensive to do that. So obviously some rockets, you know, will the first stage will land again, like SpaceX's, but that's the exception, not the rules at this point, for all the rockets that are going up there. And there's still most of the rocket pieces are not being, or don't have controlled reentry. They have uncontrolled entry. Guess where most of them come down? Just which, you know, part of the world, north,
the
south.
Ocean.
Which ocean?
Which hemisphere?
Oh, southern hemisphere.
Southern hemisphere. Yep.
Because there's mostly, less land.
No, it's not. It's not. That's, it's purely because of just orbital mechanics. It's just the way they send up the rockets and whatever. It just so happens that most are going to end up coming down in the southern hemisphere. But if we want to mitigate this, we really have to enforce international standards of, you know, you really have to make sure that everything comes down in a controlled way, like you crash it in the ocean. Also, there's the issue of space junk too, you know, things that end up getting fully into orbit, you know, like the last bit may, the last stage, anything that, you know, is with the probe, you know, the satellite all the way to the end is by necessity also in orbit, right? And just drifting around. And so those have to be deorbited, you know, in a controlled way as well. But anyway, that's going to be an increasing problem, and the numbers are not insignificant. All right, we'll keep going backwards to number two. Researchers find that intranasal oxytocin is effective in improving emotional sensitivity and relationship satisfaction in couples undergoing therapy. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Andrea, you think this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
The fiction.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have gone for the Steve's
drama. Yeah, didn't work this time.
That's not a bad play, though.
But this was more plausible than you might think. In fact, there was a recent study looking at intranasal oxytocin, and this is what they expected to find, but it was negative. And looking back over the research, this is a hypothesis that it may have this effect, but there isn't any clinical data yet to show that it actually does. So the idea is, Andrea, you asked about the emotional sensitivity. That's mm-hmm. exactly what they're looking for. So what the research we have shows that the blood levels of oxytocin correlate with, for example, the ability to sense emotions in others, like to know when someone else is angry, to know when they're happy.
Yeah.
And the idea being that, you know, spouses may not be detecting the emotion, you know, of their spouse during a conversation. And so it leads to misunderstandings and arguments and fights. And if we just give them some oxytocin, not only does it reinforce their bond, it also makes them more emotionally sensitive. So that's the working hypothesis. But the data is, at this point, it's only correlational with blood levels, not anything showing that if you give them oxytocin, it has that effect.
Right.
This was like one of the first attempts to show that, and it was negative. So it's probably going to be a failed strategy. But what it did show is that couples need therapy. Like they actually need, like, you know, it's not a substitute for actually having, doing the hard work of therapy. Yeah. And you wouldn't, you know, it's also a little simplistic. The idea that you're going to take a drug and it's going to make your marriage better is kind of a little bit of wishful thinking.
Sounds like an episode of Black Mirror.
All this means that a new study finds that smart thermostats designed to save energy through efficiency can increase strain on the electricity grid and worsen peak demand is science. Bob, you were closest in terms of figuring out why it is. Did you read the study? Because you were pretty close. It's all because they're synchronized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the worst part of it, so there's a couple reasons why they're so synchronized, and a couple of you kind of hit on why in terms of the big picture because of user error. What are most people doing that are causing this? Do you
overriding?
Think? No, they're not doing anything. They're allowing the factory default settings to be left in place.
Password.
So they're not setting it up correctly.
They can't figure out how to set it up. They don't know how to change it. So they just say, oh, screw it. I'll just leave it with the factory default.
Oh, God.
And
so every single one turns
exactly.
on.
Exactly. So what they're finding, what the study found, was that you have all of these smart thermostats turning on the heat at 6 a.m., exactly on the dot. So then you have this sudden peak demand.
Yeah, and it's
also bad because it's before the sunrise. So you don't even have the solar power, you know, to help. It does occur when wind energy would be available. But still, the end result is that they got to turn on a lot of gas powered, you know, power plants right at 6 a.m. In order to deal with this surge of demand that's happening because all these factory default thermostats, you know, are coming on at exactly the same time.
Wow. I'd be pissed, man.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. And it's not the case that I imagine it has to be pretty spread out. Like I'm like put in a random number generator and go 6 a.m. plus or minus a minute or two, but that probably
But I think that if you, let's say you had, like the manufacturers set the factory default in 5 minute increments from 5:45 to 6:15. So at least there's a half an hour, you know, in which
ramp up
rather than all coming on exactly at six. But also they said there needs to be, you know, they need to be more user friendly and there needs to be more hand holding so that people can set them up properly. Because not everybody needs them to come on at 6. It's just that they're just lazy and defaulting to the factory default. And so if they could choose when for it would come on, they probably would be more of a variety of when they would be coming on and going off and all that sort of stuff. So it wouldn't be this default synchronization. But it is a funny unintended consequence because the smart thermostats do save energy, so they could be pretty good. They also can do they can shift electricity use to off peak, which is like their primary purpose, because then that helps the grid and it's the energy's cheaper, so it saves you money. When I say efficiency, that's more of like how much you're paying for electricity, not necessarily the total power used, because it's shifting a lot of your energy expense to off peak, which is cheaper. But it's not so good for the utility company if they're all coming out at the same time. So, and that could more than offset the environmental advantage, because when you, the worst thing about peak demand is that utility companies, they start with their best sources of electricity, like, right, the most environmentally friendly, cheapest, all that stuff. And then they go progressively down the, you know, to the less and less efficient, cost-effective and more polluting forms of energy. And so when you get to that peak demand, that's when you're turning on all the fossil fuel, you know, power plants. And so it's bad. You know, it's bad for the environment. It's bad for the utility company. And leveling out the power usage is a good thing.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody recently about electric cars, and they were like, oh, you know, if we do switch over to electric cars, won't that require a lot more electricity production? It's like, yeah, not as much as you think, because, you know, the electric cars are all going to charge off peak. Yeah. Like when for our electric car, when you pull the car into the driveway, you plug it in and you forget it. And then it automatically charges itself in the wee hours of the morning off peak. You know, so it actually helps the utility company because it helps level out their production. Mm-hmm. You know, anything that levels out demand is a good thing for them. So
here's what we do is we set the factory default for electric cars to stop charging at 6 a.m.
There you go.
When the thermostats kick on, and then if they do it right,
well,
there's no
blip. But at least for our Tesla, the way it works is it says, when do you want your car to be ready for you? Like, so when are you leaving for work in the morning? So if you're leaving at 8 o'clock in the morning, it will time everything for 8 o'clock. Not only does it time, make sure the car is fully recharged by then, but it also conditions the battery so it's ready to go and could also heat up the car for you. So yeah, it's cool. Really cool.
For Bob, it'll pour his coffee for him.
Right.
Yes.
Right. All right. Evan, you got a quote for us?
Yeah. And Andrea, you just talked about random number generators, didn't you? How
sure
did you know this week's quote was going to be about that? That is remarkable.
I think the crystals told me.
It must have been. Marvel. Or the tiny T-Rex arms. Something.
Yeah, they were holding the crystals, which is how I saw them.
That's right.
Yeah. Which is what the arms are for.
Exactly. Here's the quote. Anyone who attempts to generate random numbers by deterministic means is, of course, living in a state of sin. Which is funny. John von Neumann.
Neumann? Is it Neumann?
Neumann. Neumann, I believe.
I've heard Neumann.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I heard Neumann as well.
Is Neumann?
N-E-U-M-A-N-N. Hungarian.
Okay.
Hungarian, but also American. Perhaps best known for his work in the early development of computers. And he developed MANIAC, M-A-N-I-A-C, Mathematical Analyzer, Numerical Integrator, and Computer, which was at the time the fastest computer of its kind. This was back right after World War II, so in the late 40s, early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, he was awesome.
Yeah. Bob, I know you'd know him, but I like...
That's funny that you said he's best known for the computer. I mean, I know that he did that, but I know him from a game theory perspective.
Co-wrote the classic text Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. He was,
awesome.
He contributed to fields of math, mathematical logic, quantum mechanics, economics, and game theory. So he's quite the brain.
So cool.
Yeah.
Awesome
dude.
All right, Andrea, it was wonderful to have you on the show.
Yes.
Yay,
thanks,
Andrea.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be
Come
here.
Come back.
Thank you. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, see you again soon.
I would love to. Yeah, this is great. I'm going to look up T-Rexes for the rest
totally.
Of the
yeah. yeah.
And thanks, everyone, for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
You got it,
Thank
Steve.
You, doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.